Hey, pleasant Monday to you. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. It's Monday, May 3rd, 2021. On our show today, the city of Fort Smith will soon experience something it or the rest of us haven't experienced in more than a year, a larger gathering of people. The Steel Horse Rally is returning as a pandemic has yet to end, but it's happening with an approved plan. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda will report. And in our second half hour, Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History selects legendary editorial cartoonist George Fisher as this week's subject for our Pryor Center profiles. A note about this Monday edition of Ozarks at Large: it's all new material, but it is being produced with an early deadline, so we will not have updates regarding Arkansas's Department of Health numbers of COVID-19 or other news from the past 24 hours. You can keep up with the news every weekday morning, though, at 5:30 and 7:30 on KUAF with Antoinette Grajeda. And later this week, our Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday shows will feature archives from our past 31 years, archives that are made possible with support from the Women's Giving Circle at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large. After a year-long hiatus due to the pandemic, the Steel Horse Rally is returning to the Arkansas River Valley May 7th and 8th. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke to the founder of the charitable motorcycle rally to learn what we can expect from this year's event. And Antoinette brings us this report.
When the COVID-19 pandemic led to restrictions on large gatherings, the 2020 Steel Horse Rally was rescheduled for August before eventually being pushed to spring 2021. Dennis Snow, president of the Steel Horse Rally, says emotionally, postponing the event was tough for everybody.
Obviously, that is our biggest fundraiser of the year. It's the event that allows us to give hundreds of thousands of dollars to charity. But to keep the doors open of the Steel Horse Rally was pretty much a trick in itself, because we didn't have the fundraiser last year. In fact, we didn't do any fundraisers. A lot of times we'll do golf tournaments or motorcycle rides. We were unable to do anything last year, and it really financially put us in a strain. It got very, very tense there for a while.
Snow says they were able to survive the challenges of last year and are hoping for good weather for the 6th annual rally this year, which will support 4 local charities: Antioch for Youth and Families, the Buddy Smith Home for Veterans, the Children's Surface League, and the Fort Smith Museum of History. More than $100,000 has been donated to charities during the event's first 5 years. More than 290,000 visitors have attended the rally, and Snow anticipates thousands will show up this year as well.
We're just so excited to be able to do it this year. We did a very detailed plan, which got approved by the state of Arkansas, so it is an approved event. And if history continues and the crowds continue to grow, this will be the largest weekend event in over a year in the entire South. So we're very, very excited about that, a little bit nervous. We encourage everybody to be smart, be safe, be alive. If you're more comfortable wearing your mask, of course, you're not required to, but we certainly strongly recommend that you wear masks, social distance, and we'll have several hand washing stations set up throughout the entire area of downtown Fort Smith.
The 2-day rally features events in Fort Smith and Pecola, Oklahoma. Live music and entertainment will be showcased on the main stage, which this year will be located in the parking lot at 601 Garrison Avenue, across from First National Bank. Organizers are also introducing a new event, the Cops and Cones Motorcycle Exhibition.
The Steel Horse Rally is dedicated to all who serve, law enforcement, military, veterans. And this year, we decided to highlight our brothers and sisters in blue with Cops and Cones. And at 10 a.m. on Saturday morning, May the 8th, we're going to take over Garrison Avenue on the corner of Towson and Garrison. And police departments from all over the great state of Arkansas are coming on their beautiful Harley Davidsons. And they'll be running a precision motorcycle course. No admission charge to watch.
In addition to raising money for charity, the Steel Horse Rally also supports local businesses. According to the Fort Smith A&P Commission, the total estimated local economic impact of the rally has been $60.6 million over the course of its first 5 years. With the return of the rally, Snow says the thing he's most looking forward to is seeing people again.
There's such a brotherhood of those who ride motorcycles, two and or three wheels. And we've kind of gotten, there's people that come every single year from all over the United States and other countries. And we've kind of gotten used to seeing those smiling faces and giving hugs. Of course, this year we won't be able to do the hugs, but I am really looking forward to seeing friends come in from Tennessee, Georgia, like I said, all over the United States. And that's going to be the main thing. It's just the camaraderie ship again, the ability to get together.
The Steel Horse Rally is May 7th and 8th, and a complete schedule of events is available at thesteelhorserally.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
A new wind farm owned by Southwestern Electric Power Company and Public Service Company of Oklahoma is now generating renewable electricity to SWEPCO customers in Arkansas. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, two additional wind facilities under construction will also go online in the near future.
The sound of a giant wind turbine, part of the new Sundance Wind Generating Complex in north central Oklahoma near a place called Clio Springs.
It's 199 megawatts and 72 wind turbines in this particular facility.
That's Peter Main, spokesperson for SWEPCO. He's based in Fayetteville.
And it's part of an overall project that will bring 810 megawatts to our customers over the next year and a half or so.
Two additional wind farms, the 287 megawatt Maverick and 999 megawatt Traverse facility, are also under construction with planned commercial operations in late 2021 and early 2022. Called the North Central Energy Facilities Project, it's situated in some of the most wind-rich territory in the U.S. Maine says the new wind farms will add to SWEPCO's existing high-efficiency natural gas and coal-fueled generating units.
So our long-range plans do move us toward a cleaner energy future, and we're adding more low-cost wind, and we will be adding more solar as well. Also part of that transition, as previously announced last year, we will be retiring coal facilities in Texas, two of them, one in 2023 and one in 2028. And we have one in Louisiana that is retiring later this year. So this is all part of a larger transition in our generation resources, the resource mix that is serving our customers. And just yesterday, Wednesday, the 28th, we issued a request for proposals for additional renewable energy resources up to 3,000 megawatts of wind and up to 300 megawatts of solar. So that's a process that will play out over the next couple of years, receiving bids, evaluating bids, planning to bring some additional renewable energy online to serve our customers.
The three wind farms are being developed and built by Invenergy, and upon completion are being purchased by SWEPCO and Public Service Company of Oklahoma.
Invenergy is one of the largest renewable energy developers in the country. This is a significant project for them and for us. They are constructing the facilities for us, and then we purchase these facilities from them at the time that they go into commercial operation. So on April the 14th, when the Sundance facility began commercial operations, began delivering energy into the regional grid, SWEPCO and our sister company PSO acquired the ownership of Sundance, and the same will take place later this year with Maverick and into next year with the Traverse project.
SWEPCO, an American electric power company headquartered in Shreveport, Louisiana, serves more than a half million customers in that state, as well as Texas and western Arkansas. And SWEPCO's investment in the North Central Energy Project is slightly over $1 billion. But the wind farms, Maine says, will save SWEPCO customers approximately $2 billion over the 30-year expected lifespan.
So when you add a significant amount of wind energy with zero cost for fuel to the overall fuel cost for SWEPCO providing electricity for our customers, it reduces the fuel cost to customers.
The wind farms, he says, will also fulfill sustainable renewable energy goals set by municipal, business, and individual customers. American Electric Power recently set a new goal to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050, with an interim target of 80% by 2030.
We're making a significant move toward that goal with the issuing of requests for proposals on April the 28th. For 3,000 megawatts of wind energy and 300 megawatts of solar energy and some short-term capacity. And what that means is that over the next couple of years, we will have a process where we will finalize that those requests for proposals. We will receive bids by a deadline in August. We will then evaluate the bids, and we will submit proposals to the regulatory bodies in Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas for approval of whichever resources are selected as a result of that request for proposals process. So it is a competitive process.
Back in 2018, AEP, SWEPCO, and PSO announced plans to invest $4.5 billion into an Invenergy-built 800 wind turbine facility and dedicated transmission line in the panhandle of Oklahoma called Wind Catcher Energy Connection. Approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, as well as public service commissions in Louisiana and Arkansas, the project had to be scrapped after Texas rejected the plan. With existing and this additional new wind generation, Maine says SWEPCO customers can purchase renewable energy credits through SWEPCO's Renewable Energy Choice Program.
And when they do so, they would end up paying a price per kilowatt hours, and they can choose the percentage of their kilowatt hour usage that they would like to apply to that purchase. So they're able to purchase the renewable energy credits. And then the proceeds from those sales flow back into the fuel portion of customers' bills and actually benefit all customers in Louisiana and Arkansas.
In late April, the Biden-Harris administration held a historic summit with 40 world leaders to tackle the urgent climate crisis. Biden declared America's recommitment to the Paris Agreement post-Trump by leading a global clean energy revolution that will yield economic opportunities, job creation, and environmental justice. We provide a link to SWEPCO's long-range clean energy plan on our news site. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Springdale-based Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas was among the first organizations a year ago to host a virtual event as the pandemic took serious hold of our lives. Now, in 2021, the HWOA is preparing for its annual May Festival once again, and much of it is, again, virtual, but not quite all. Last week, we reached Berenice Alcala, the event coordinator for the Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas, to find out what their hybrid festival will include on Saturday.
So a hybrid festival, meaning that we will be merging two different components, a virtual component with an in-person one. So virtual, where we will be featuring local and international talent. We will have lots of giveaways, lots of raffles, sharing really great information. We will get to meet past scholarship recipients and also get to meet the scholarship recipients that were awarded this year, which, by the way, we have 25, which is amazing. And the other component, and why it's called a hybrid, is, of course, we know given the circumstances, we are not yet able to full-on have an in-person event. However, we want to bring back those elements that we were not able to incorporate last year. So we will be having a drive-through food sale from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., so the duration of the festival, but also we will be having a drive-through free COVID-19 prevention vaccination clinic that will be happening that same day, the same location, from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. So that is where the hybrid name comes from.
And what I've known with past festivals your organization has put on, whether they be virtual or, you know, in person, is you get to meet the scholarship winners, but there's also entertainment. That's the same this year?
Yes, yes. We will have entertainment. So this year, it will all be featured virtually, of course, since we are not having a full-on in-person event just yet. So that is something that everyone can look forward to. And this year, we have so many amazing local artists that will be joining and supporting the cause.
You can give us an idea of some of those artists, who they are?
Yes, we can give you a bit, just a general idea, so that way people can tune in and they will have to see.
Oh, is this a surprise?
I don't want. We definitely have. Yes.
I don't want to spoil any surprises.
Give too much away.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have, you know, mariachi. That is something that's very typical and very popular among our culture. We have various traditional dancing from, you know, countries like Mexico, Nicaragua, Panama. We have lots of actually international artists that are going to be supporting us all the way from Mexico. So they're creating exclusive content just for us. We have lots of amazing bands, singers, a few comedians. So we have a little bit of everything as far as talent goes. So we are so excited to be able to show all of these artists off and what they have prepared just specifically for this event.
You mentioned the scholarships being awarded this year. I think in something like the last 20 or 21 years, it's almost been now 500 scholarships awarded.
Yes. We're at 588, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yes, yes. So that's something that we are so proud to announce. 488, sorry. But we are adding 25 students more this year. Each will be receiving a $1,000 scholarship. So, you know, this event is a scholarship fundraiser to benefit. So everything, every single dollar, every proceed that is made or generated from this festival is going to go right back to that scholarship fund so that it helps us reach our goal of increasing the number of Latino students that get to attend a higher education institution.
Who can attend the festival? Virtually, of course. And how can they attend?
Yeah, so this is a free festival. It's family-oriented, open to any single person that would love to come. As you mentioned, it's going to be virtually, but also I do invite them to come by. So the address is 614 East Emma Avenue in Springdale, Arkansas, 72764. That is where the drive-through food sale and also the drive-through free vaccination clinics are going to be happening. So that is the hybrid portion that people can definitely participate in if they want to, you know, come and join us. And also stay tuned in. Facebook Live is where we will be live streaming, and people will have the opportunity to win prizes, enter raffles, and of course get to enjoy the amazing entertainment and scholarship recipients that we have prepared for you all.
All right, I'm not going to ask you to name a favorite food that's going to be available in the sale, but give me one or two that you think people will look forward to.
Ooh, I would say perhaps there's this really popular one, pupusas, and also some very delicious drinks. But that's all I'm going to say, so people will have to stay tuned in if they want to see the full menu. But I definitely encourage everyone to stay tuned and to come and participate and support the Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas.
Finally, you know, this is a festival, and it's a good time. But we're, what, more than a year into what has been a rough time for so many of us. What has it been like the last 13 months for you and your colleagues at the Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas?
Yes, definitely. It has been a rough few months, but I believe that the one word that encompasses it for all of us is adaptability, the ability to just create and find new pathways to be able to carry on the events that we usually do. With the pandemic, we are not able to have that same face-to-face outreach. However, it has been a lot of learning, I believe, learning, adapting, and every single day learning something new to be able to improve our programs, the way that we host host events. And also, you know, I think how you remember, we were one of the first organizations last year to host a virtual festival. And so I believe that, you know, I see us as also pioneers of finding new ways and still be able to have the same impact. So we are working very diligently over here at HWOA to ensure that we are able to have that outreach and that community members know that we are here for them.
Anything else you'd like to add? Anything I've neglected to ask?
Well, I think just I want to invite every single person who would like to be a part of this festival and tune in on May 8th, Facebook Live, where we will have our virtual presentation, and also to come and visit us at 614 East Emma Avenue, Springdale, Arkansas, 72764 for the drive-through food sale and also the drive-through COVID-19 vaccination clinic. So all of that information you will be able to find on our website and also on our Facebook page. So I hope to see everybody there.
And please let it be known that Bernice can keep a secret.
Yeah, I think that way we all have something to look forward to. We don't want to give away too much.
Hey, thanks so much for your time and cheers to a great festival.
Thank you so much, Kyle, for the invitation, and I'm very excited for this and hope to see the community members show up.
Berenice Alcala is the event coordinator for the Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas, based in Springdale. Their Hybrid May Festival is Saturday. You can learn more at the HWOA Facebook page.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
To get the idea for the cartoon, you have to read, keep up with what's going on, and observe, and try to keep an open mind, and try to be fair. You're boiling a complex idea down into one picture. And sometimes this gets pretty difficult, and it's hard to be fair and do this. So it takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of concentration.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me is Randy Dixon, who's with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy, whose voice did we just hear?
That was the one and only George Fisher, who was an amazing man. He was editorial cartoonist for years for the Arkansas Gazette. But he was much, much more. He championed a lot of causes that helped our state. He conservation, the environment, and he was even a fan of folk music and could play the banjo. And from what I understand, he was pretty good.
And back then, when his cartoons were appearing statewide, he was easily a household name throughout Arkansas.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, he was a huge draw for that newspaper. People would, look for his cartoons every time, you know, an edition came out with him in it.
Had you planned that pun? He was a huge draw. Did I just serve that up for you?
I'm not going to say.
All right. All right. So we've heard his voice. What else are we going to hear this week?
Well, he was so popular that KATV Channel 7 did a lot of news stories on him and interviewed him in a lot of situations. And the first thing I want to crank up here is not early on in his career, but it was when he was publishing a book. He published several books and had a great reach. And a reporter for Channel 7 named Hartzell Reagan did a feature report on him.
George Fisher's newest collection of editorial cartoons and political caricatures is the culmination of 2 years' worth of Arkansas Gazette drawings. As the state's foremost political and editorial artist, Fisher, his newest book, covers all social categories. Its purpose, says Fisher, is to refresh the public's mind on the most recent political issues.
Recently, I'm delighted to hear teachers tell me that they are using them in classrooms because it's current history, and young people, students, relate to these because they read them in the paper, read about them in the paper, and they see them in the paper. And I'm so delighted that it is something that can be used in education.
Fisher published his first collection of political cartoons in 1966, and this latest release is his fifth book. This is Hartzell Reagan, News Scene 7.
You know, I also talked to some of his friends. First of all, journalist Bill Lancaster, who, by the way, was also known as Scoop, was a close friend of Fisher, and he knew him not only as a journalist when he worked with him, but he was sort of on the other side of the fence, you would say, because he entered the world of politics. In 77, Lancaster left reporting and started working for the House of Representatives and then became the Senate's first chief of staff. And so he ended up spending a quarter of a century of his career at the Capitol. But he had some thoughts about his friend.
Well, George was a quiet man. He talked like a silver-throated evangelist, you know. He had this mellifluous voice, and you know, he was a celebrated war hero from World War II. He's an infantryman who fought in World War II and won the Bronze Star. But you never would have known that. He was a very humble, quiet, and easygoing man. He was born up in White County somewhere. I don't remember exactly where, but after the war, he worked at the West Memphis newspaper, and I believe it folded, and George and his wife moved to North Little Rock, where he, believe it or not, he had a little TV show where he had puppets, and they would have politicians come into the show to talk to the puppets that George and his wife had.
Oh, and by the way, did you catch that he had a puppet show?
Yes. I wish we had recording or
apparently,
something.
Apparently, you know, from my research, it was on Channel 7. Hmm. It was on KATV. And so I'm going to just knuckle under and try to find some of that footage. Unfortunately, you know, back then it was live television.
Right.
And there wasn't any kind of way to record a live broadcast. But I'm going to see if I can find some of that puppet show that he and his wife, Rosemary, did.
And we're going to hear more about Rosemary later. But first.
And she plays a big part.
Yes.
But another one of his friends is Malin Rice. He was a journalist and editor and now with the Washington County Historical Society. And he had some thoughts about Fisher and the style of his cartoons.
You could look at the cartoon. And I mean, he spoke volumes with his work, and his drawings were succinct, and they made a point. They didn't usually have a lot of text in them. It was easy to figure out what he was saying and what was wrong. From prison reform to just outright theft from the highway department to mismanagement to outspoken legislators who, you know, they always had a big cigar in their mouth chomping on it, and they were always big, fat people, you know, legislators were. And but George Fisher had the way to poke the bear and make things happen. And it's like the Corps of Engineers. He's the one that he saw one of them somewhere, and on his desk supposedly was a sticker that said, "Keep busy." So every time he drew a cartoon of the Corps of Engineers and their atrocities in the state, trying to dam every free-flowing stream, they always had on this keep busy button. Every one of them on the uniform had on an Indian pith helmet and a keep busy button. So, I mean, he was able to buttonhole people and just put them in their place.
I remember distinctly the stay busy in the cartoons.
I do.
And I never knew until now what the origin of that was that Fisher would use that all the time.
Well, I didn't either until I spoke to Mr. Rice. So, yeah. But he was very, very outspoken about the Corps of Engineers. And, you know, as he said, its intent to constantly dam rivers. So here's an interview with Fisher about the use of his editorial cartoons and champion the environment.
Well, the editorial cartoon probably serves several purposes in that it exposes the issue to the public. It makes the developers or anybody who is developing the environment, that is Corps of Engineers and people like this, mindful
that there are people who have different points of view on priorities of nature. It also gives heart to the people who are conservation-minded, environmental-minded, and such.
George Fisher, the subject of this week's Pryor Center profile. I'm talking with Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. He did so many editorial cartoons about the Corps and dams that he could fill an entire book.
Well, and he did. He published a book, and it dealt strictly with the Corps of Engineers and the damming of rivers. And here's a quick interview from Channel 7 about that.
Well, the purpose of the compiling this book is to point up and to dramatize the issue of conservation in Arkansas. Many people think that we are one of the last of the frontier states, and that we're sort of untouched by the developers. But I think we're becoming aware that some of this is vanishing. For instance, the streams in Arkansas and the rivers are all becoming almost, we have lost all but one of the rivers, that is the free-flowing rivers, to the dams. The Buffalo River, you know, is now scheduled to be a national river, but we almost lost that. Development is fine. There is no argument here of black and white, good guys and bad guys. It's just a matter of priority that somewhere down the line we're going to have to start thinking about our natural resources and reevaluating our priorities.
There were, because at the height, it seems like Fisher was in the newspaper 6 or 7 days a week, the Gazette, when he was at the height of his popularity. And there were certain
things. Right, he was cranking things out.
Yeah, and there were certain things he would revisit. We've talked before, you and I, about the old guard home, where once a politician was sent out to pasture by voters, he would put them there. Bill Clinton, because he was so young when he was Attorney General, was put on a tricycle.
In a little Lord Fauntleroy kind of
yes,
outfit.
Yes.
And so, then, you know, David Pryor with his, he had his hound dog.
Oh, that's right.
And yeah, so everybody had, you know, and well, Frank White, because of Creation Science, had a banana.
That's right. I forgot about that. So,
yes.
So there was this sort of, I mean, he could be sharp in his criticism, but there was also a certain amount of, hey, now you're somebody if George Fisher has drawn you.
Well, yeah, and that's what Malin Rice points out here. I mean, if he drew you, you'd made it.
But if you ended up in a Fisher cartoon, either Wednesday in the North Little Rock Times or Sunday in the Arkansas Gazette, there was lots of people laughing and telling you need to do better and look out, you messed up again.
Now, you know, yeah, you'd made it, but he could have some stinging portraits of you if he didn't agree with you.
Well, that's true. But he did do it in a really nice way. I mean, everyone I've talked to has said that he was such a nice guy and could, you know, pin you in the nicest way, but in a fun way and in a sharp way. But Jim Pitcock from Channel 7 talked to him about, you know, how much criticism he might get about it.
Have you ever received a lot of criticism over any particular cartoon?
Yes, but it usually doesn't come from the subjects themselves. It usually comes from other people who are connected in some way, usually from the thin-skinned people who want to be heard from and who are just irritated. But usually people like Faubus and Rockefeller, people like that, they learn to live with this sort of thing.
It's Jim Pitcock talking to George Fisher, who is our subject of this week's Pryor Center Profiles. Before we continue, I just want to put a shout out to John Deering, whose editorial cartoons we've seen in the Democrat Gazette for years now.
Yes.
He, too, is a treasure, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. We've talked about the love of the environment and Arkansas's natural state that George Fisher had, that extended to music and the Folk Center in Stone County.
Yes, he loved the heritage of Arkansas and loved Stone County. And he was very instrumental in on several fronts in the formation of the Ozark Folk Center and the saving of the Buffalo River. And I believe, like I said, he was a banjo player and was a good buddy of Jimmy Driftwood. But here he is talking about, you know, preserving the heritage of Stone County and North Arkansas.
I think.
Well, how difficult is it going to be to preserve the heritage in Stone County?
The culture? I think it's going to be very difficult. But there are people like Jimmy Driftwood who are aware, and many other people, of course, who are aware of what this culture really is. And we might here guard against the change, that Nashville made, for instance. Nashville, Tennessee, where the Nashville that is the country and western capital of the world. We hope to make this the folk center of the world. Will the people here, for instance, change? Will the singers and the musicians shed off their overalls and start wearing sequins on their clothes? Will the craftsmen start thinking more in terms of commercialism? I don't know. I just believe these people are very genuine, and I believe that it would be a long time before they really change to that extent. I hope we can keep the quality that the people, these wonderful people, have.
And this is how talented George Fisher was and is. From decades ago, he's actually providing me a chance to do a forward promote to Thursday's Ozarks at Large, because our conversation that we recorded a few months ago about Jimmy Driftwood will be on Thursday's archived edition of Ozarks at Large. So,
just excellent.
Yes. All right. We mentioned Rosemary earlier, his wife. If you were a fan of George Fisher, you knew his wife's nickname very well.
Snooky.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, as a kid, I would hit the paper first thing, and I didn't go to the cartoons.
Mm-mm.
I went to the editorial section and would look. He would hide the name Snooky in there, you know, hidden somewhere in the cartoon. I mean, did you do that?
Oh, my goodness. You would go to school the next day, or that, you know, later that day, because you'd get the Democrat in the morning or the Gazette in the morning, and you'd look at it. And, you know, you'd check the box scores of baseball, you'd read Pogo, and you'd look for Snooky, and you'd go to school and you'd talk to your friends whether they had found it or not, back when people read newspapers.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was very easy, and then other times you really had to spend some time with the cartoon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it was really tough sometimes. And you'd have to ask your friends for hints if they had found it, you know. But anyway, Bill Lancaster talks a little bit about Snooky and her role in the cartoons.
His wife became a fixture in the cartoons because he would hide her name in every cartoon that he drew. The people around the state caught on to this, and they started looking for the word Snooky hidden in the cartoons. So it became a kind of a game with all the subscribers around the state. He just, you know, I was working with George at the Gazette. I went there in 73, and George moved over from the North Little Rock Times to the Gazette in 76. And he just started being a statewide hero to people then. And the Gazette, right during the 7-year stretch we were there, it was at an all-time high in circulation. People love those cartoons.
It was so much fun. And again, I it's hard if you didn't grow up or you don't remember the George Fisher cartoons, just what an impact he had on the state.
Oh, he did. And, you know, I talked to Malin Rice about, you know, what he thought his legacy might be.
He was able to change some things in Arkansas or draw attention to things that needed change. I think that was his biggest thing. Here's a problem. We have a problem with the state prisons. We have a problem with the state highways. We have a problem with being last in education. He wants somebody to do something about it. And I think that's his legacy.
One other thing we need to talk about is the word Farkleberry comes up
right
whenever you mention his name. And it's a bush. It's a real bush. But I think he brought the name into the public by his cartoons. And the story is someone was driving down the road and saw Governor Faubus along with a road crew raking up, refuse and things from the side of the road, and there was a Farkleberry. I have a hard time saying that, Farkleberry bush, and it became part of his routine, and they actually started the Farkleberry Follies, which was a play put on every year by the Press Association, and they would poke fun at all the politicians and the issues that were going on, and everybody came.
It was the Central Arkansas version of what is Gridiron up here.
Yes.
Thursday on Ozarks at Large, we'll re-air the session like this that we did about Jimmy Driftwood. You and I are taking next Monday off. We're going to make room for the last installment of The Movement That Never Was, Anti-Racism in Arkansas in the South. But then 2 weeks from today...
Hey, thanks for the day off, Bob.
Well, I'll double your pay. But 2 weeks, 2 weeks from today, we'll be back with another brand new edition of Pryor Center Archives. And you can go to the Pryor Center's website and find so much to spend time with. Randy, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been great. Thanks, Kyle.
So how in the world do astronauts sleep in space? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto manager, and this is Scratching the Surface. In space, there is no sense of up or down, north or south, or even really day and night. At least not in the same definitions as us Earthlings. There are about 16 sunsets and sunrises every 24 hours on board the International Space Station. So one could guess it's not that easy to designate when it is time to sleep. That's why we keep astronauts on a rigorous daily time schedule, usually giving 8 hours of sleep at the end of each mission day, or what we call a day full of tasks like maintenance or daily experiments. Because of the constant change in lighting from the sun, we recommend astronauts wear eye shades or pull down shutters over the windows. However, it has been noted that most astronauts feel fully rested after only 6 hours of rest, and this is probably due to the weightlessness of space and the body tires less quickly, as opposed to gravity working against our muscles here on Earth. But how do we sleep without bumping into everything? The astronauts have sleeping bags located in small crew cabins that are attached to the walls, and each cabin is big enough for just one person. For more segments of Scratching the Surface, visit KUAF.com.
The KUAF Pluto manager, Caitlin Ahrens, studied space and planetary sciences at the University of Arkansas. She's currently a postdoctoral researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Scratching the Surface is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
This is Ozarks at Large. It's early May, and at the first of every new month, that's kind of redundant. But anyway, at the first of each month, Sherry Ottaviano, our membership director at KUAF, comes into the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to tell us somebody is about to be very happy, a listener of KUAF.
That's correct. Donald Evald of Pea Ridge, Arkansas, is the winner of A Night Out on Us. I will be sending Donald tickets to the Malco Theaters and a gift card to Mockingbird Kitchen for dinner. And we're very appreciative.
Yes, and that means that he, like thousands of others, is an active supporter financially of KUAF.
That's correct. Donald contributed during the month of April, and his name was randomly drawn to receive a token of our appreciation.
Anyone who contributes during this month will be eligible to hear their name in about a month.
That's correct.
How do you contribute to KUAF?
Oh, many ways. You can make a one-time gift. You can set up a monthly sustaining gift. You can do that online. You can do that by getting a KUAF membership login where you can look at your gifts, your historical gifts, make a change to your current gift, however you want to do it, or you can actually call me here at the station.
All right. Sherry Ottaviano is our membership director at KUAF. Talk to you again in a month.
You bet.
Here are a few simple facts. The sky is blue.
1 + 1 = 2.
And when you wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News, you start your day prepared with information you can trust. Listen every weekday.
Morning Edition every weekday morning from 5 to 9 on KUAF. Here's a word many of us don't want to hear or say. Incontinence. The condition is rarely mentioned, but can be a quality of life issue and often misunderstood. We continue our series about health, aging, and quality of life in cooperation with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences with a conversation about incontinence. We recently talked with Laurel Sexton, assistant professor at UAMS in the physical therapy department with a specialization in pelvic health therapy, about incontinence.
So the actual definition of incontinence would be the loss of urine. We certainly have other things that can be associated with that. People complain of urgency or frequency and not have a loss of urine, but incontinence itself is the actual loss of urine.
Are there signs, symptoms that, I don't know, incontinence is a possibility in your life? Are there things to pay attention toward?
Sure. That makes me think of what's normal. Right? What kind of urine habits are normal and what things are not normal? Because I think there is some misunderstanding around what's normal about urinary incontinence and what's not. So first off, there's three different basic kinds of incontinence. And one of them is called stress urinary incontinence. And then the basis behind that is that you're going to leak usually small amounts of urine with activity. So maybe when you're jumping on the trampoline with the kids, or you're running for exercise, lifting weights, even just coughs and sneezes, but you're doing something and usually it's small amounts that are lost. The second kind is urge incontinence. And urge incontinence is more of a, I have an urge to go, but I can't get to the bathroom on time. I tend to leak some urine on my way to the bathroom. And then the last one is a mixed incontinence. So it's kind of a mix of those two. There's certainly other kinds, but those are the three main ones that we see. And so when you're looking at, do I have incontinence or not? Can you get to the bathroom on time? And are you leaking any urine with activity? But then the other part of it is for you to say, is this normal? And I think one of the misunderstandings in society is that incontinence is normal in some populations. And then those people aren't getting the treatment that they could get. And the treatment, why is treatment important? Treatment's important because it's a quality of life. We have people that, you know, they know where every bathroom is. And so they're running to the bathroom. They go to the bathroom before they leave the house. So they feel like the life revolves around the bathroom. They won't go to church. They won't go to social activities because they're afraid of the smell or that leakage may happen. So it impacts their life. They may quit going to the gym and exercising. So that's why we want to treat it. And those populations that probably don't realize it's not normal is after having a child.
Postpartum,
absolutely. One of the most common kinds of incontinence and one of the common things that women experience after having a baby is stress urinary incontinence. So having some urine leakage when they're doing an activity. And unfortunately, they feel like, you know, everybody says this happens after I have a baby. So I guess that's just me. And they tend to just accept it, that that's the way that it's going to be. And there's actually a lot of things that we can do, conservative treatment that we can do to help with that and make that go away in those populations. Conservative meaning outside of medications or surgery. Another population would be women that are kind of in that perimenopausal menopause time frame, because as our hormones are changing, some of the support structures for our bladder are changing. And so that can start to cause some leakage as well. Again, usually a stress incontinence, but very many things we can do conservatively to help them too. So there's no reason for them to compromise their quality of life. And another population that we don't talk about very much is our men. Mm-hmm. Our men, the prostate surgery that they get for prostate cancer often results in a stress urinary incontinence that can easily be addressed conservatively after surgery. So those are kind of there's some other populations, but those are probably the main ones that people always think this is normal and I have to live with it.
But if I'm hearing you correctly, you perhaps don't have to. You mentioned some conservative treatments. What would those include?
So if stress incontinence is the problem, one of the misconceptions is that Kegels is all you have to do. So Kegels are contracting your pelvic floor muscle, like you're trying to stop the flow of urine or gas. And people think, well, that's all I've got, so I'm just going to do some Kegels. And if those don't help, then I guess nothing's going to work. And actually, with stress urinary incontinence, Kegels are helpful, but we also have to control our pressures in our abdomen. So when our pressures, when everything's coordinated and working like it should, pressure comes up and out our mouth when we do a cough or in our exhales as we're exercising and things like that. But when our system is not controlling our abdominal pressures well, the pressure goes down. And when it goes down, it pushes on that bladder and we have some leakage. So we in physical therapy can do a lot to help people learn how to coordinate their breathing, their abdominals muscles, and their pelvic floor muscles to control their pressures so they don't leak, in addition to Kegels. With urge incontinence, it's even easier. It's super easy with urge incontinence because all that is bad habits.
Really?
So we just, yes, all that is bad habits and bad training. Your bladder is a muscle. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to the bathroom when you don't have an urge and you're drinking irritants like tea and coffee and things like that, the bladder will start to shrink down a little bit and it can't expand and hold as much urine as it's used to. And so it will start to give you really frequent urges, and then you get to where you can't control those and get to the bathroom in time. So we just educate people what's normal, what's not normal, and help them change some of their habits.
You mentioned that this is a quality of life issue. It's something that a lot of people don't want to talk about. I imagine there are people who are hesitant to bring this up with their doctor or their medical professional.
Absolutely. Some of it is they're embarrassed to talk about it, so they don't want to bring it up. Others maybe have brought it up before and were told that there wasn't anything that can be done in the past. But, you know, a lot of new research is out and we know there are things we can do about that now. Or maybe they've talked to some friends or family who say, well, yeah, I know, me too, but that's just the way it is. So they're either hesitant because they're embarrassed, or they've said something before and others have said, well, I think this might be normal. So we just have to get the word out.
Laurel Sexton is an assistant professor at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in the Physical Therapy Department with a specialization in pelvic health therapy. She talked with us via Zoom as part of our ongoing conversation about health, aging, and quality of life in cooperation with UAMS. This is 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville. Contributors to our Monday show included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, and Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Timothy Dennis produced today's show. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Dr. Caitlin Ahrens. It's produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at KUAF. Our thanks to Sherry Ottaviano, our membership director at KUAF, for stopping by as well. We'll be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m., brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thank you so much for being with us. Don't forget, you can always find us at ozarksatlarge.com. We have a podcast available through all the major podcast distributors. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening.